just said. But I think we need to look more closely at the monetary processes. And I think that analytically, there are two distinct sides to the story that's been unfolding over the past 25 years or whatever Andrew picked out. But I would argue there was something else going on than just the system thing. There were actual policy changes that had made it operate worse. So that my two sides are, first, high interest rates. Second, high lending. It's my only effect. I want you to remember it. And it follows, the reason I do it is because this is a characterisation of monetary stance. I shan't tell you what my partner suggested last night. But it follows a characterisation of monetary stance. Now, this morning I attended a presentation where people were just talking about that. They were just talking about money being easy or tight, you know, too much money around, too much debt. But in actual fact, I think we need both. And I think that the particular cause of the crisis is this block here. It's money that's both dear in terms of price and easy in terms of quantity. You have to look at both aspects. I've got the fuller story that sort of outlines the presentation is a story that goes basically from a flow of credit creation to outcomes in terms of income that determines whether loans can be repaid, to an inflation in the stock of private debt when they can't, and then finally to a financial collapse or credit crunch. Fundamentally, I believe that future incomes are less likely to be able to repay loans under high interest rates than low interest rates. The notion that low interest rates are behind the crisis, I think, is the most dangerous notion of all. Equally fundamentally, I think the process has begun in the corporate sector. The most important process is in the corporate sector. As we should all know, Keynes was mostly concerned about the corporate sector. So I'm going to talk about money and interest. Going back to this framework, this isn't a neoclassical framework. This framework doesn't really work in neoclassical economics. In neoclassical economics, you have a one-to-one relationship between the rows and the columns. So if you've got low interest rates, you've got easy money, and they just use them interchangeably. But it does work for Keynes, and I think for any sensible analysis of money. For me, if you have a bank money system with paper money in a central bank, the creation of credit is basically free. If the creation of credit is basically free, the rate of interest can be anything you want. And it's set according to social conventions, conflicts, or whatever you like. But it becomes like a sort of volume knob for the economy, if you like. And it's obvious from historical statistics. If you look at statistics of interest rates, it's a fantastic book by Homer, appropriately named. And as soon as central banks are created, interest rates fall. Now, Keynes extended and formalised this sort of notion as his theory of liquidity preference, and he analysed money as a store of value. He saw the long-term rate of interest as a premium for parting with liquidity rather than a reward for saving. It concerned the decision after the decision to save had been made. I say that because it's, that was his critical understanding. So with that understanding, he figured out how the authorities could then use debt management policy alongside monetary policy to set interest rates across the whole spectrum. And hence, especially if the authorities could set interest rates across the spectrum, they could sort of control the interest rates that governments borrowed at and that companies borrowed at. I've got an illustration here. Everyone knows this theory of liquidity preference, but I see, this is a supply and demand graph, basically, but it has the price of one thing against the supply of something else, the supply of money, the price of bonds, say. But under the old world, the authorities like to control the amount of money, and their debt management policy is to keep short-term debt very restricted and have long-term debt. So if they want to restrict the amount of short-term debt, the market controls the long-term. Well, I'm not going to dwell on this because I've written this in papers. But according to Keynes, if you wanted to set the rate of interest, you just had to accommodate what the public wanted to in terms of short-term debt. So you could set the long-term rate of interest like that. But moreover, he said, it's not just like that. The public will get used to it. Liquidity preference shifts. So, Grant, you could reduce the rate of interest and at the same time keep a reasonably acceptable quantity of treasury bills or whatever in the economy. I just say this to emphasise the fact that Keynes thought you could control all interest rates. And Keynesian economics hasn't been interested in that in the slightest. I'll just hold on a sec. Two very substantial points follow from this, I think. First, setting the rate of interest becomes the goal of monetary policy above all others for Keynes. And in order to set the rate of interest, he had a number of policies, which basically would have been discussed earlier. First, he switches bank rate off, no longer manipulate that. Then he made changes to debt management policy. Again, I have a paper that explains these, but it's essentially you issue debt according to what the public wants. You don't issue debt according to what you want the public to have. You put a wider range of maturities. You extend the floating debt. Keynes created this instrument called Treasury Deposit Receipts so that if people wanted more short-term debt, they could take out these Treasury Deposit Receipts, but they weren't allowed to deposit them in the Bank of England to extend more credit. So he'd sort of got an advice in it. It was a sort of device to keep money, you know, reasonably restricted, reasonably tight. He also, as we've heard, had capital control and he wanted policies of exchange management. So it altogether amounted to a regime where money was cheap, but it was tight, and he was sort of controlling the amount of money as well. Now, that's his policy, but the second thing that follows from his theory of interest is that the rate of interest doesn't do what it does in the classical scheme. In the classical scheme, it's a terribly clever thing. It's adjusting for time preference, it's keeping saving and investing in line, it's adjusting as the rate of profit falls, it's doing this job. But in Keynes's theory, it isn't. It just is. The rate of interest just is, and then the rest of the economy has to try and figure out how to work around this rate of interest. That's just to show his policies for interest rates. So that's where he wanted to go. He wanted to go into that quadrant. So what about activity? Sticking with Keynes still, Keynes has the rate of interest as a critical determinant of aggregate demand through the marginal efficiency of capital. Very simple. He has a theory that there's an aggregate schedule of the marginal efficiency of capital, which firms assess to see how much investment they want to do. Depending on the rate of interest, determines how much investment will be done. The other assumption to this theory is that the money supply is endogenous, so that it will expand to meet whatever demand firms have for investment. The rest of aggregate demand then follows through sort of standard Keynesian policy, but this is the bit that's really important. The sum of all the parts of aggregate demand leads to an equilibrium, and it's an equilibrium where demand is the same as supply. The equilibrium can be stable, but obviously not all resources they're not fully utilised. It's obviously highly likely that you're going to get unemployment. And this mechanism for the long-term rate of interest to unemployment is very fundamental. It's lost in the Keynesian literature. It's by no means in all the post-Keynesian literature either, though. You see it in Kahn, in Chick, in Passanetti, in Rogers, I don't know if Mark and Jesper want to sign up to it. But I think it needs debating a bit more. But that's just background Keynes. We want to talk about the cycle process, and the cycle process comes from here, but it comes from changing animal spirits. I can get it very simplistically through shifting animal spirits. So animal spirits get going, firms get optimistic, their assessments of the returns on capitals are shoved out, so you get much higher investment. Then firms get less optimistic, the NEC falls, you get lower investment. I think if you read something like Schiller, that's probably the sort of process he's got in mind in his book. In my view, there's more to it than this, especially in Keynes. He talks about investment in a correct state of expectation. I could give the quote. So it's an essential characteristic of the boom that investments, which will in fact yield 2% in conditions of full employment, are made in the expectation of a yield of, say, 6% and are valued accordingly. So he has this sort of overestimation against something which he seems to be implying is setting a limit to the amount that investment will make. I think that's important. So investment won't yield what's expected to it, and he seems to think that investment's going to fall short. So it suggests to me that in Keynes he has this sort of notion of a correct marginal efficiency of capital. Investment can go up to there, but that investment won't yield what's expected. It will only yield what's down there. And this is how I would define the easy money situation. the rate of interest set in the economy is permitting that much investment, but firms have got optimistic. They've gone out there, they're going to do this much investment, but they're not going to make it. That it won't be sustained. We then move into financial considerations, which I think are all very Minsky, and we become interested in, we're interested in when the revenues of any investment meet the expectations of the revenues when the investment was put in place. So it's quite a sort of long-term perspective. For these investment projects, according to Keynes, they won't meet their expectations and all the cash flow calculations will go awry. But we're in a monetary economy, and there's plenty of ways around this. Loans can be rolled over. The financial sector will and has proved incredibly imaginative over what are basically mechanisms for distressed borrowing. In Minsky's language, Ponzi finance becomes endemic. So rather than becoming repaid, debt is accumulated. And then accounting considerations mean that in parallel to what I think is a debt inflation will be an asset inflation. But eventually the system collapses. But I would argue that the collapse is endogenous to the process. It's not just shifting animal spirits, because it follows a recognition that there's a level of debt that can't be repaid, which has at root investments that can't pay their returns. It's not a whim of the market, and it's not an exogenous shock. And I don't think it's the falling rate of profit. It's about expectations of profit. Now, the collapse will begin in the financial sector, but it's instantly transmitted to the corporate sector. Finance dries up, interest rates rocket, firms go bust, and people are sacked. When the crisis comes, suddenly the finance dries up and the marginal efficiency will collapse and firms get... And we're into a very vicious cycle. I think that's where we are now. If you looked at the quarter one business investment figures, business investment fell by about 10% in all the major economies, in Japan, in the US, in the EU. Not quite as much as 10, but that was going on. So now, for Keynes, the solution was terribly simple. He thought rather than achieving investment I1 through exaggerated expectations, you should just reduce the rate of interest, and you can achieve that rate of investment through reducing the rate of interest. Would it be sufficient to stop the cycle? An intuition might be that it's easier to learn low than high interest rates. You're not jerking around bank rate with monetary policy and manipulating expectations. If you're at full employment and you try to expand, you get inflation. So there might be arguments that says that the economy would be more stable in such conditions. The other thing, I guess, is the evidence, what Keynes used to call the evidence of experience. So this is a terribly important chart describing the history of the economy. I can put it in six. These are high interest rates in the 1920s, which Keynes has driving the Great Depression. Then you go into the 1930s. Sorry, I should explain what they are. They're real interest rates on corporate bonds, because I would consider these the most important ones, because these are the ones companies are paying. So in the 20s, you have high interest rates that Keynes was worried about and thought caused the Great Depression. So then in the 30s, you see rates being shoved down. If you looked at the government rate, this is all much smoother, but the corporate one's more important. So they force them down, and by the time there's the war, they're very low. Then throughout the Golden Age, they're held relatively low. I mean, it's almost bizarrely even, this data. I can't believe the smoothness of the results myself, given what inflation was doing. You get into the 70s, they go low. If you're on government bonds, they go negative, and it's obviously very silly. But then you come up here, and they go berserk. Homer, the historian of interest rates, notes that at this point, you've got long-term interest rates that have never been reached in sort of modern history. So for me, the deterioration in the world economy that we're all completely familiar with since 1980 has really these rates of interest. These rates of interest make it more difficult for firms to invest, and they also make the economy more prone to cyclical swings. The other thing... I should use this characterisation. I can fill up my boxes now, if I like. So this in a sense is my answer to those who are trying to blame low interest rates at the moment. I would note that what we've had over the past few years is incredibly easy money, which has been cheap. It's not what Keynes wanted. Keynes wanted low interest rates, fairly tight money, and he wanted interest rates aimed at the productive sector of the economy. But the notion that low interest... Sorry, I'm losing my thread a bit here. The other thing I want to talk about the Golden Age is that it wasn't just because this emphasis on interest rates. It wasn't just government expenditure that was driving the growth in the Golden Age. I would argue that it was private investment. These are contributions to GDP as percentage shares. So if you're looking in the 50s, GDP grew by 4.1%. 57% of that on the demand side was contributed by consumption, 20% by business investment, and 28% by government. So what you see is in this Golden Age period, business investments playing a high part, so is government. But then you see after the 80s, you see business investment going all over the shop. You have an absurd period in the 90s, but not very much in the 80s, and then virtually nothing in the 2000s. But investment was terribly important to the Golden Age period. So I just dwell on the Golden Age. So I do think that the Golden Age could be argued to be a sort of triumph of Keynes's period policies. It wasn't driven by government expenditure alone. Business investment was terribly important. The rate of profit was high. Also, there wasn't a debt inflation, which we'll see shortly. And I agree with Radhika that it wasn't Keynes, but it was a bit more Keynes than what we'd had before and what came after. Then we get the 70s. So going back to the 70s, we have liberalisation beginning. Bretton Woods is abandoned. Credit controls are abandoned in countries. Minsky, I note, says that liberalisation begins in 1966 with the euro bond market and banks lending to each other. Debt inflation. And then in parallel, there's a debt inflation. This is US corporate debt as a share of US companies' profits. And what I would argue here, that over this period where interest rates were relatively low, there wasn't a debt inflation. But as soon as finance gets liberalised, or begins to be liberalised, you get a large acceleration in debt.
Do you have to finish in a few minutes?
Yeah. So, I find that driven by high interest rates. If people want to talk about interest rates, they want to point the blame at low interest rates. We have Greenspan blamed for cutting interest rates in the wake of the collapse of the new economy at the end of the 20th century. Others want to blame the savings of the Chinese. Yet, as I said earlier, the phenomenon of most importance, it seems to me, isn't interest rates, but the vast increase in the money supply. And underpinning this growth in the money supplies is the growth of derivatives, which some hold have grown from 0 to 600 trillion in under 10 years. I think that's probably the easiest money in the history of the world. Liquidity preference, the causality is obvious. You've got an increase in the money supply, which is pushing down the rate of interest. And if you remember, go back to that chart, the rate of interest fall in the 2000s was very incidental compared to the previous period. Central banks completely ignored it. But now interest rates have gone back up. And furthermore, of course, that increase in the money supply was really a response to the previous crisis. It was teetering on the brink at the end of the 20th century as the new economy proved an illusory expansion underpinned by corporate debt. The policies that have been pursued in the 21st century are about as far away from Keynes's policies as it's possible to go. It was incredibly easy money. I was going to talk about Keynes and Marx at the end, but I won't. I'll come back to that later. I want to make the point that the underlying interest rate movements are terribly important to the process, and that the Golden Age and the sort of high period of economic growth could arguably be a result of policy, not just, you know, underlying developments. I'm going to hash that. Sorry, thank you.